This podcast is presented by Regions Bank. You're chasing your goals, and it's up to you how you want to get there. Let Regions Bank coach you with financial tips that fit your everyday grind. Visit regions.com/next-step to learn more. Regions, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. This week, my guest is Baylor Athletic Director Mac Rhodes. Universities are in the process of bringing their athletes back on campus now that the NCAA has given a thumbs up to voluntary workouts. In the SEC, those workouts can start as soon as June 8th. In the Big 12 and Pac-12, schools get to have their athletes back in their facilities on a voluntary basis starting June 15th. In the Big 10 and ACC, schools are being permitted to make those calls on their own. It's the first step toward having a college football season, but what does it all entail? We'll ask Mac Rhodes to walk us through Baylor's protocol for testing athletes, monitoring athletes, trying to make the new normal as safe as possible during a pandemic. Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us on Westwood One Podcast, Apple Podcasts, just about anywhere you like to get your podcast. Please subscribe. And if so inclined, give us a good review. It helps college football fans find us, and it helps us find more college football fans. And away we go. Joining me today on the podcast is Baylor Athletic Director Mac Rhodes. He is one of the finest in the business. He has done it at University of Houston, University of Missouri. He has been leading Baylor 4 years now at Baylor? 5 years, Mac. Which how long? I'm losing time here.
You're losing time. I'm losing time. But it will be 4 years in August. So,
all right.
Almost four.
Yeah, dog years to a certain degree. You walked in there at a difficult time, but of course nothing like it is right now because these are unprecedented times and we've never seen anything like it. So what we want to talk about today is we have athletes returning to campus now all over the country. And soon, June 15th in the Big 12, different dates in different conferences, they will be allowed to voluntarily work out. So basically they'll be allowed on their own to use the facilities, which is a great thing for a lot of these athletes who have been sort of, you know, on their own trying to figure out how to stay in shape for football season. A lot of football players, we're going to have different athletes also coming in after that. I want to talk about how that works, testing, protocols, all these things. So let's start with this. How are the athletes arriving and when? We talked a little bit in advance, so I know you're talking about groups, but so give us an idea of how and when you're bringing the athletes onto campus, and then we'll talk about what you're doing with them.
Yeah, so thank you, Ralph, and I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. And, you know, let me preface it by saying, you know, I think the start of the race has a lot to do with how you finish it. And so this onboarding process, this beginning process of returning our student athletes to campus is really, really important. And we obviously have to be extremely thoughtful. Our medical directors, our health and wellness team, they are the experts, and they really have to guide and lead the way. And so, you know, the Big 12, agreed that you know, June 15th could be the starting date for football student athletes to return, as you mentioned, for voluntary activity. And so we Baylor, we have a phase approach. We have five groups. We have this initial group, which we really, you know, consider our pilot group. And it's a collection of student athletes that are here in Waco right now that are going through, you know, injury rehab type stuff, right? And we'll begin with them on June 4th, just in terms of the whole testing process. Every one of our student athletes, and again, we'll begin with that pilot group, will be tested for COVID-19. And right now that would be the PCR test. And as we know, probably not a fun test. And we're hoping as time goes on, right, there'll be a less invasive test that is accurate as the PCR. But we believe, at least right now, that the PCR is the most accurate. We're trying to determine whether or not we do the antibody testing right now as we speak today. We're not sure that it's extremely accurate. So that's kind of something that you know we'll decide as we get a little bit closer, not with the pilot group, but with our group that begins on June 15th. And then we'll do a medical plus screening. And so, again, the pilot group, June 4th, but then we'll begin with the rest of the team, June 15th. You know, we're talking about probably 25 student-athletes per group. And, you know, so much of it, it's the testing piece and how much can our medical team, right, accommodate per day. But it's also the lab and you know, how quickly, how many tests can they process per day. And so that's also been part of the conversation. And so, you know, we think it's going to take, you know, the pilot group. But then once we start on June 15 with the rest of the team, we think it's going to take at least, you know, 4 days to onboard the football student athletes. And, you know, it will certainly give us an opportunity to see how the process works. And then, you know, what kind of comfort level do we have to move beyond that, right, and think about the July 1 date with our fall sports, soccer, volleyball, and cross country, and then the July 6 date with our men's and women's basketball programs. So it will be an interesting time because, as you mentioned, it's unprecedented. And, you know, we're doing everything we can to try to educate our student-athletes prior to them landing on campus so they know what to expect.
So how do you break down the groups? Do those groups become the groups that those kids hang out in? So you said there are five different groups. The first is a pilot group of kids who have generally been around Waco. Are there standards for the other five groups that you want to keep, let's say, similar kids, maybe from similar areas together? Now, I'm using kids, athletes. Some of them certainly don't look like kids, though they may act like kids sometimes.
No, it's a great question. And so, you know, really working with the coaching staff to think about the groups, right? And, you know, that first group, June 15th, you know, that will be certainly your returners. And I think that it will be a combination of, you know, looking at depth chart and also, though, looking at young men they're coming from high risk areas per the, you know, CDC level 3 areas. You know, we're currently having conversation right now to even bring them in a little bit sooner because we're going to, you know, self-quarantine, at least our plan right now, even though, you know, Texas has lifted any quarantine. We're going to quarantine them for at least 7 days as we speak today.
And that's kids from certain high-level risk areas. Only those yep. kids get the quarantine?
Yep. And, you know, that will be, yes, and that will be, you know, per the CDC guidelines. You know, they have, you know, obviously looked at the different areas. And so anybody, you know, level 3 area, we'll go ahead and do that. And then we'll continue, again, the next group with returners, and then the fourth group returners, and then that last group, that group 5 on June 18th will be our freshmen, our newcomers, and we'll finish with them. And again, there will be a waiting period of, you know, probably 2 to 3 days following that onboarding before they'll be able to begin any type of physical activity.
Not quite a strict quarantine, but hey, we at least have to wait till we get your test back.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And to see what those results are, you know, look like before we'll allow any one of our student athletes to begin the physical activity piece. And then, as you know, once we begin the physical activity piece, you know, the weight room, we will have a schedule, that is very clear with all of our student athletes, time slots. And, you know, for us, and because of the size of our weight room and social distancing, for us, you know, it'll be no more than 24 student athletes in the weight room at any one particular time. And, you know, if a student athlete misses their time for that day, then they miss their time and they'll have to wait till the next day.
Do you set those, and I'm not even sure if you've gotten this far into the detail, but do you set those groups' times by specific groups? In other words, let's say, are you going by position? Are you trying to keep kids who live together or plan to live together in their groups? Because I know ideally you would love probably for positions or at least offense, defense, because a lot of times those kids end up having similar workouts, but that might not always be the best for the athletes because a DB may live with a wide receiver.
Again, great question, and it's yes to both.
Okay, yeah.
I think we're looking, you know, we're looking at both, you know, like positions, but also, you know, trying to keep our student athletes in groups, you know, together throughout this whole voluntary, you know, time, this process, right? And right now, you know, we're not quite certain when the voluntary activity will finish, and then we get into, you know, the summer required activity. And during the voluntary activity, which we think will last, you know, at least 3 weeks into the month of July, we can do a pretty good job of you know, keeping student athletes within certain groups. Now, once the summer required activity begins, and again we're guessing sometime in July, that's harder to do. But until we get there, let's try to do the very best that we can to keep them in groups. And of course, Ralph, what you worry about is this is 2 hours a day, right? So what are our student athletes, what are our young men, as it pertains to football, doing the other 22 hours? Mm-hmm. And so just trying to also educate as best we can to, you know, talk about not only the responsibility they have to themselves about, you know, taking care of themselves, protecting themselves, but also being responsible about protecting others. And making sure that, you know, you're putting yourself in a good position where you're not, you know, putting your teammates or your coaches or your athletic trainers or, you know, anybody else at risk. And so that's a big piece of this as well for us. And you know, right now our conversation that you and I are having has been limited to our student athletes, but we're also going to test our staff. Mm-hmm. We're equally, you know, concerned about our staff. And, you know, when you think about age, right, mm-hmm. we have staff members, football coaching staff members, or, you know, if we're talking about voluntary, you know, strength and conditioning staff members that could be in the high risk areas. And so we're trying to make sure too that as we onboard staff, we're very, very thoughtful on how we do that as well.
What does the cleaning process look like for those weight rooms? I imagine it is an exhaustive and, quite frankly, maybe even costly, considering how often you're going to have to hit those weight rooms when those players come through them.
That's a big part of this. And, you know, the Big 12, I'm certainly proud of the way, you know, we as a conference have handled all of this. And, you know, one of the early decisions was to bring on an infectious group, disease group out of Duke, and their former name was DICON, but working with a gentleman, a doctor by the name of Christopher Hosler. and who is, you know, one of the leaders in this group, is one of the leaders of working with, you know, professional sports leagues and really, you know, trying to educate on the prevention of you know, infectious disease, the spread of infectious disease. And so we're relying and have relied on him specifically as to, you know, maintaining facilities. And this idea of, you know, our facilities have to be pristine, have to be very much like, you know, a hospital, mm-hmm. in terms of the prevention of the spread of infectious disease. And so, you know, we've developed, or we're developing, standards, and, you know, we'll be, you know, very rigorous in terms of how we maintain our facilities. And, you know, that's going to have to be every day. And we have gotten down to the detail as to what everybody's job responsibility will be in terms of cleaning that facility. And some of it will be on our student athletes. Some of it will be on our, you know, athletic performance, strength and conditioning staff. And then some of it will be on our cleaning employees. And so, that effort, absolutely has to be, you know, coordinated, and you know, we're going to have to be really diligent about doing that every single day.
I almost forgot to ask you about masks. Will Baylor, not just you, but will Baylor require the athletes to work out in their facilities with masks? That could be tricky. It's not necessarily the most comfortable way to work out. I guess if your weight room is big enough, you might be able to use some social distancing to accomplish what you would ordinarily with a mask. People are grunting when they're lifting weights. What's the mask policy?
Right now, at least, you know, our preference will be that you have to wear a mask. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's going to be for student athletes. That's going to be for any staff that's in the building. We think that's the most responsible, and certainly understand maybe it's not the most comfortable. You know, we're going to mandate that you wear a mask, at least for our student athletes and for our athletic staff employees.
Do you have, will they have access, I assume they will have some access to fields. In other words, if they want to use the practice field, quarterbacks and wide receivers maybe throwing a ball around, can they have their own football? I don't think they're allowed to get a football from the staff yet, which is one of those quirky NCAA things, but are they allowed to go on to a practice field and throw a ball around?
That's a great question. And, you know, candidly, I don't have an answer for you today, because it's something that we're talking through, right? You know, all of a sudden now, if you open up the indoor, for example, for, you know, student athletes on their own to go throw the football, and now do you have a collection of, you know, 50 student athletes, 75 student athletes, right? Mm-hmm. And again, this whole idea of trying to reduce the risk of the spread of an infectious disease. Well, the more people together, right, it's higher the risk. And so we are, as you and I, you know, are having this conversation, we are, you know, talking about that very subject matter. You know, how are we going to regulate that? Do we regulate that, right? I would tell you that, you know, right now, if anything is available, it's probably going to be an outdoor field. Mm-hmm. And if we move forward and we allow our student athletes on their own to do anything, I would say that, you know, we would regulate the number that could be, you know, out on that field at any one time. So that's the conversation that we're having.
Yeah, the education piece on this is going to be really, obviously, the more I talk to folks like you, really so vital. And it's just, you know, and again, like, you know, I know you recruit good kids and smart kids, But gosh, I mean, they're 18 to 22 year olds, and 18 to 22 year olds often feel invincible and don't always make the best decisions when they're on their own. I found it interesting what you stressed about the idea of sort of making them understand it's not necessarily just about you, right? Like if you can impart to them in the ways you motivate them to do the things for the team, this is something you do for the team. If you want to have a great season, here's some of the things you need to do to act responsibly to have that great season.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Coach Aranda and I've had the conversation about what a great opportunity this could be, you know, to build unity within the team, right? And to build accountability for one another, right? And build, you know, what I think would be, you know, really or add to a healthy culture, right? That, let's as football student athletes, and again, we're specifically talking about football right now, but it would be for all of our student athletes. But, you know, as football student athletes, let's take a lead. Let's take ownership in this, right? And let's hold each other accountable to making sure that, just, you know, as members of campus, as members of the community, right, that we're responsible and how we, you know, and how we handle ourselves, right, and that we take this serious, and I know this, right. There's not a student athlete that you know would want to go out and expose themselves now all of a sudden, contract, you know, COVID-19 and then give it to their teammate or give it to, you know, their coach, right, and or their athletic trainer. And so to have these conversations up front, and I think it's going to require some of our team leaders to really, really embrace it. And then, you know, to have this sense of accountability within the program. And so we've got great kids. We really do, and that's not to say that they're perfect, nor am I. And we know they're 18 to 22 years old, but I do have faith and confidence that they'll take this serious and understand that this is, you know, much bigger than just them, just themselves. It's about this whole idea of community, which includes their teammates and some of the people that, you know, that they're that they love and care about.
This is not to sort of pit one school against another. There are different approaches here, and even the NCAA guidelines, and they are just guidelines, told schools, hey, you don't necessarily have to test everybody. So there's not a one-size-fits-all. However, Oklahoma within your conference has decided, you know what, we're going to wait a couple of weeks, and we're going to open up July 1st. And I had a chance to listen to Joe Castiglione, sort of walk through that on another colleague of mine, Andy Staples at The Athletic. Joe C was on his podcast, and they explained why they went about that way, that they thought that was the best approach, to wait a little while before you gather all these players and maybe in their minds run the risk of possibly spreading, somebody gets sick or somebody, excuse me, contracts the disease or the virus and spreads it. Again, that's not to say your approach is wrong or their approach is right, but did you give any consideration to those things? As you sat down with your team, how much consideration was, well, pros and cons here? We get them on campus, but were there some cons that made you think, well, maybe it's better to wait a week or so where these are only voluntary workouts? If you could, take me through that thought process.
What we tried to do was really listen to our medical team, and you know, we continued to ask the question, are we ready, right? Will we be ready? And Ralph, I agree with you 100%. 2 weeks difference in terms of voluntary workouts, when you think about competitive inequity, I don't believe that there is a competitive inequity. And so, you know, for us, the way the Big 12 activities policy reads is that student athletes can begin voluntary activity on June 15th. We Baylor decided we're not doing that, right? We don't think we are or will be ready to do that. That would mean that we would have to begin our onboarding process
that's a good point,
four
right.
days before June 10th, June 11th. And so, you know, we said, no, we're not going to do that. You know, conversation, dialogue with again, our medical team, with our health and wellness said, hey, we feel really comfortable that we can begin the process of onboarding on June 15th. And so, you know, that's how we arrived at our decision. I've got great respect for Oklahoma, you know, for them and their medical team and health and wellness group, right? They felt that, hey, for us that, you know, this, we feel good about July 1. And again, as we, you know, the Big 12, there were probably, you know, a couple schools, Ralph, that were ready to go on June 1. Mm-hmm. And, but we as a conference, you know, made the decision, hey, let's try to coalesce around one date for the good of the group. And then certainly if there's an institution or two that want to go after, like Oklahoma is, or, you know, maybe like Baylor is, although it's just, you know, 3 or 4 days, that, you know, that's certainly left up to the institution.
I know you don't have much more time. I want to get to one more on this. And this is the first step, and things are looking hopeful that we will have, I don't think it's going to be a normal football season, but we will have a football season that starts at the normal time. Give us a quick glance at what the next steps are. It just seems like an endless amount of boxes to check here. But when you start, okay, now we've got the onboarding part piece. We're hoping to pull that off, but we have to keep looking ahead. What does the next thing look like, or that the next thing you're trying to sort through protocols for?
Yeah, so again, I think, you know, the onboarding process, you know, being really systematic and from one phase to the next, and not necessarily within football, but from one phase to the next with the variety of sport programs. And so how does that process go throughout the month of June and July? And then, you know, once we start, you know, summer required activity and now coaches are involved. And so protocol, when do we onboard, you know, our coaching staff, right? When's the right time to do that? What are all the protocols and guidelines that we'll have to take staff through, which, you know, we spoke about just briefly, right? And then beginning to think about, you know, the 6 weeks, and I think we as an industry have really coalesced around this 6 weeks, you know, period of time, this, you know, maybe 2 weeks of summer access required activity and then the preseason. And, you know, once you get to the preseason piece, you know, now you're talking about, you know, 110, you know, student athletes together and not separated, and coaching staff and making sure that we're prepared for that. And then, you know, as you look into the season, and think about that, you know, how, and we've got to be thinking about this right now as well, but how do we manage, right, if we have a student athlete contract COVID-19, or a staff member contract COVID-19, and making sure we have a plan on how we mitigate that. And, you know, as we again think about the season, what about, you know, if there's an interruption in play? You know, what about if you know, Baylor's getting ready to get on a plane to go play at Oklahoma, and one of our student athletes or staff members, we learn, you know, on that Friday before we get on a plane, that they have COVID-19. Well, how do we handle that, right? Do we play the game? Do we not play the game? And you know, if we don't play the game, then is there a way to make it up? And so thinking about different scheduling models, and do we move back the champ game by a week or two so that we have a week to make up if we do miss games? And so all of those things are, you know, conversations that we're having, and it's hard. It's hard for all of us because we want clarity, and there can't be, you know, that's probably the hardest piece of all of this, is that there just can't be clarity at this point in time. And so, you know, you have to have guiding principles, right, to help make sure that we make decisions, we make the right decisions for the right reasons.
Mac Rhodes is the athletic director at Baylor. Mac, when your mom said you should have been a doctor, or you should be a doctor when you grow up, you probably could have used that right now. Who knew that a great career in sports administration, you really should have gone for that medical degree?
I should have. So that's what I get for not listening to my mom. So
Mac Rhodes from Baylor. Hey, thanks a lot for doing this. I really appreciate you giving us all this information. It's really important stuff that our fans and college football fans and fans of college sports need to know as they hopefully look towards what will be a college football season and a college sports season in the fall. Thanks, Mac. Good luck to you with all the things that you're working on right now.
Thank you, Ralph. Really appreciate the opportunity. And stay healthy and safe.
You too, my friend.
This podcast is presented by Regions Bank. You're chasing your goals, and it's up to you how you want to get there. Let Regions Bank coach you with financial tips that fit your everyday grind. Visit regions.com/next-step to learn more. Regions, member FDIC.
And now, 3 and Out. And this will be a little longer 3 and Out than usual, since our chat with Mac Rhodes was pretty tight. First down. Last week, after this podcast posted, quarterback JT Daniels of USC announced that he was transferring to Georgia. Daniels was a 5-star recruit from Modern Day High School in Southern Cal. That school has been a USC quarterback factory over the years. Daniels followed Matt Leinart and Matt Barkley to the Trojans and played pretty okay as a freshman. I think okay is a solid way of describing how Daniels played as a freshman. He went into last season as a starter, but I think it's fair to say that people who were close to USC could tell that Keaton Slovis had the potential to usurp Daniels. Then before Daniels even had a chance to assert himself, he blew out his knee in game one, Slovis took over, and the rest is history. So where does Daniels fit at Georgia? He will probably apply for a waiver to become immediately eligible, because why not? Even with Wake Forest transfer quarterback Jamie Newman in the fold, Daniels could provide added competition and or depth. If Daniels is not eligible, it leaves Dwan Mathis as the likely backup behind Newman and gives Daniels a chance to head into 2021 as the likely starter. Though, Georgia has another 5-star recruit waiting in the wings to join the team in the 2021 signing class. If things play out perfectly for the Dogs, Newman starts this year, Daniels starts next year, and then hops to the NFL, and Brock Vandegrift, the 2021 5-star, is ready to roll in 2022. Second down. Tough news for Clemson receiver Justin Ross, who will have surgery on his spine and miss the 2020 season. Ross has a congenital fusion, and whether he plays again is no sure thing. He is a brilliantly talented and big receiver who seemed likely to step into T. Higgins' role as Trevor Lawrence's number one target this year. It sucks for Ross and for Clemson, but of course the Tigers have reinforcements. They also return Amari Rodgers, who is a smaller receiver, more of a slot guy, but experienced and talented. The rest of the group includes lots of recruiting stars, but not much production. I think it's fair to say that last year's crop of highly regarded freshman receivers, including Frank Ladson and Joseph Ngata, were a little disappointing for Clemson. Neither asserted themselves, and while Ross was having a somewhat disappointing sophomore follow-up to his great freshman playoff breakout, there was opportunity for one of the young guys to grab some more playing time. That really never happened. And when Higgins got banged up in the playoff, you could see the Tigers were a little short on outside weapons. Now, it wouldn't be surprising at all if either of those guys blossoms as a sophomore. And there are other high-ceiling options as well at Clemson. The Tigers should be at least okay at receiver, if not much better than that. But if you're looking for a little uncertainty on the roster of the likely preseason number one team, the loss of Ross provides a small dose. Third down. Let's keep talking about Clemson for a moment. It gives me a little path to talk briefly about the very sad and disturbing current events in the United States. Dabo Swinney might be the most high-profile person in college football right now, even more so than Nick Saban, if only because Dabo is a little more comfortable putting himself out there, so to speak. Saban is a little more guarded, though trust me, Saban is neither camera shy nor incapable of talking about big picture issues in an effective way, if so motivated. Saban was one of many coaches who put out some type of statement recently decrying racism, expressing shock and anger about injustice, calling for tolerance and healing in the wake of the death of George Floyd, a black man who died while being detained by white Minneapolis police officers. Saban's statement was fine. I see a lot of those statements because my Twitter feed is set up to catch just about everything a coach and an athletic department tweets. So it's easy for me to get jaded when another one rolls across the timeline. But I understand those coaches are speaking directly to their number one constituents, their players, most of whom are black. So again, I get a little skeptical, if not downright cynical, when yet another white offensive coordinator posts a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King. That's not entirely fair on my part. I have to take a step back and think, you know, at the very least, this person made the effort. It's hard to imagine a person could spend that much time around young black men and their families and not have some genuine empathy toward the fact that they have had challenges in their lives that white guys like me have not. So then there's Dabo, who spoke for about, 5 to 8 minutes on Monday about current events, mostly talking about his faith and believing in the goodness of God and how he hoped his team could be an example of unity and love that society could model. It was fine. And Dabo gets extra points for actually speaking up with reporters rolling on a Zoom call. That's more difficult. He didn't take to social media. Dabo's not on social media. So again, that's a little more difficult, especially for a guy like Dabo who tends to ramble a bit, which can be endearing when talking about football, but it's easy to stumble into saying the wrong thing these days. My own opinion is Dabo's approach is a bit too simplistic and safe for tackling a problem that is complicated and provocative. Not everybody is supposed to feel good when talking about racism and injustice. That said, Dabo Swinney is a football coach, and I think in his world, he does a solid job of walking the walk when it comes to trying to develop quality citizens. It is very easy to get jaded, again, in this profession when you hear so much chatter about how football builds character. I don't believe that football is an innately good thing. I think football, along with all team sports, can be a useful tool to teach young people valuable lessons in humanity. I think Dabo Swinney makes a legitimate effort to use his football program to do that. And for me, that's good enough. I'm at the point where I don't expect every person in a position of leadership with a large platform to be part of the solution when it comes to solving the complicated problems tearing apart this country right now. What I do hope is that the majority of those people will, at the very least, choose not to be part of the problem. I think Dabo Swinney, and I hope most coaches, clear that bar. That's a pretty low bar, but right now, a lot of folks aren't even clearing that. That's the show for today. I'd like to thank my producer, Warren Levinson, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts and Westwood One Podcast. Please subscribe so you do not miss an episode. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening. Come back for more next week of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I promise next week's episode, we'll get into more fun and games.
This podcast is presented by Regions Bank. You're chasing your goals, and it's up to you how you want to get there. Let Regions Bank coach you with financial tips that fit your everyday grind. Visit regions.com/next-step to learn more. Regions, member FDIC.